You're listening to the One Last Cast podcast, your home for tips, tricks, and stories from the Texas coast. Here are your hosts, Jonathan Hua and Merrill Selesky.
All righty. Welcome to another episode of the One Last Cast podcast. My name is Jonathan, and as always, I have Merrill Selesky here. Say hi, Merrill.
Hey, how's it going?
Well, it's still the middle of winter, and it's still feeling cold, but I think spring is just around the corner, and I don't know how's the fishing been, because I haven't been fishing.
It's been the same as we went out. There's still catching trout, and probably go a little bit tonight and check on them again, but they're back in these spots that had a lot of fresh water rain off that we had recently. They're starting to come back in, so just keeping tabs on them and seeing what they're doing in their patterns has been, you know, just getting information. Be honest, I'm just hooked. I like catching fish, so I just go out and just become a routine of mine.
Yeah. So I know we left off our last episode. We were talking with Captain Justin Sifton over here about the new trout regulations that are going into effect sometime this spring. And there's a lot of questions. We had a lot of comments in the chat, and so much so that we kind of decided that we needed to talk more about it. So,
or get to the source, right? Like get the right information. So, because I felt like there was a lot of questions that I felt like even myself didn't have the right information. So we decided to dig through our resources and see if the people that knew more than us could join us. And this is not, we're beating up on anything really. It's more of just being informed, right? To know the truth, what's really going on, and the right information, because there's a lot of wrong information out there about this. And to just get the right information is kind of the idea of this podcast.
Absolutely. And I think our kind of saying goes as is, you know, an informed fisherman is a better fisherman. So, So before we bring on our guests, definitely want to give a shout out to our sponsors, Knocking Tail Lures. If you're looking for a great soft plastic, go ahead and give them a shot. Knocking Tail Lures, you can search them at knockingtaillures.com, and you can, they just have a great action. I've been using them for the last four or five years. They've been awesome. Also, 4A Printing, they do all of our custom merch. That's our towels, buffs, and shirts. I think they do shirts as well. As anything custom that you need, give Aaron a shout, and he will get you hooked up. Also, Dirty South Kayak Anglers, if you're looking for a Facebook group to join and talk kayaking and fishing up and down the Texas coast, go and find DSKA or Dirty South Kayak Anglers on Facebook. Also, cannot forget Brittany Selesky, Merrill's lovely wife. If you're looking for Houston real estate, either commercial or residential, give a shout out to Brittany Selesky. You can reach her at 281-740-0498 or Brittany, that's Brittney, at grindstonerug.com. Also, for our listeners out there who are live or are listening to us via podcast, we are live every other Tuesday. You can find us on our Facebook page at facebook.com/onelastcastpodcast, or you can find us on YouTube as well. And I forgot to mention last time, but we do have a website where we kind of host all of our podcasts, as well as blogs and written and any other content that we have. So you can find us at onelastcastpodcast.com. So usually we kind of start off with a story, but we're just going to go into our guests right now. We have two guests backstage. I had a whole thing written down about how these are the OGs of the kayaking world, but I'm just going to bring them up because they kind of, I'll let them introduce themselves. We have Scott Null and Dean Thomas. How's it going, everybody?
What's going on, guys?
It's a pleasure to be here, man.
Awesome. And thank you guys for being here. So I guess we'll start with Scott. We're doing the trout angle here, but you know, I know that actually both of y'all are kind of, at least from my perspective, are very well known for redfish. But from a trout perspective, let's kind of look at the past here and what are some of your good trout stories? that you have, and then we can kind of table set and go towards looking at what the regulations are supposed to do for our, the populations here.
Shoot, man, I grew up on trout. Growing up around Galveston, we didn't have any redfish. I mean, redfish were netted out as they were commercial, and we're talking, you know, late 70s, and going out and fishing all summer long, catch all the trout you want. And if we caught a redfish, man, it was a big deal. I mean, we called all our buddies when we got home. So, man, we got redfish today. That was cool. But you could walk in pretty much anywhere around Galveston. You know, everything was open. There wasn't a whole lot of places that were off limits. We cut through the pastures, just kind of went wherever we wanted to go. All behind San Luis Pass, West Bay, all that was walk in, Rooster Flats, and all behind San Luis Pass, all the state park area on that way was just walk in, go do your thing. And then got a little John boat after that, and that opened up the whole world to me, man. That was Trinity Bay and East Bay, fishing Deep Reef and Hannah's, and a 14-foot John boat with a 15-horse motor on it. Dad thought I couldn't get in any trouble because I only had 6-gallon tank. He didn't know I had another 6-gallon tank at my buddy's house. So I could get in a lot of trouble, man. Leaving out of the Eagle Point and going all the way to the spending time up there. Got caught over there a few times. Had to spend the night on Smith Point once. But yeah, that's where I cut my teeth was trout fishing. I fished with Wendy Marshall, Marshall Deal. All the old time guides. I worked at Marburgers as a kid, and they were all customers that came in there. So I learned a whole lot from them. Got to go fish with them when they were scouting, and they taught me everything about fishing the deep reefs and wade fishing over on the south shoreline of East Bay.
Yeah, and that's interesting to hear Scott say that, because whenever, I mean, when you talk about trout stories, it reminds me of fishing as a kid, because it was all about speckled trout then. I mean, we never targeted redfish. And I grew up on Chocolate Bayou, Chocolate Bay, San Luis Pass, West Bay, that end of Galveston Bay. And yeah, I mean, when you sit and like, just kind of think about trout stories and memories, it does take me back to my childhood. But you know, we catch a lot of speckled trout now. Redfish are so abundant, they're awesome. Big, I mean, if you want to catch a fish that's going to bend your rod and test your tackle, the reds are awesome. And I guess there's probably more opportunity for redfish now. Speckled trout are held in such a high regard now. I mean, you get that trophy trout, and that is the prize. I mean, you can catch all the redfish in the world, and you can't hardly turn ahead with that. But, you know, you get 28, 29-inch trout, and that's the holy grail nowadays. So, yeah, interesting how that has changed over the last 40 years, man, you know, when you want to go back that far. I don't know how old you guys are, but me and Scott we're up there into twilight of the fishing program. But there's some amazing stories that still happen. I mean, the biggest trout that I've caught lately, like about a year ago, was on the fly, you know, sight casting into them. So, you know, me personally, from where it started to how I pursue trout now is very different. You know, it's a long evolution of how that took place.
Yeah, for me, it was just moving down the coast. You know, I fell in love with different places over the years. You know, I didn't have kids, but I had some money, but had a lot of time off, you know, a lot of comp time and all that. So me and my buddies would take off, go down to Port Mansfield, and we'd spend 4, 5, 6 days down there in Port Mansfield. And it was min reds down there. And then once I had kids, I had to shorten my leash a little bit. So I started fishing Rockport a lot more in Port O'Connor. And that's how I kind of ended up retiring here to Port O'Connor and semi-retiring, I guess. Guiding's not really retired, but retiring from the police department, moved in here And I don't do a whole lot of the trout these days. I mean, they're just, honestly, there's not that available around here, you know, not like they used to be. And that, I guess that's probably why I don't do it as much, is because I think about those old days of how we fished before there was limits. You know, the 20 fish limit came into effect. You know, I was fishing the day before that and caught 50 something trout. And just a kid walking out there with an old rod, old fiberglass rod, a 5500 Abu Garcia and a gold spoon, and be able to catch 50 something trout. And that's what I want to see it get back to. And part of why I've gotten into the conservation so heavily is I want to see you guys get to experience that. I want to see my grandkids get to experience that. I want to see it get better.
Yeah. One of the things that we've, you know, as anglers now that we have access to all the internet and all the resources available to us, one of the most interesting things and fascinating things, for at least for me, is seeing these old pictures of people holding up like these 100 stringer trout, a whole big stringer of trout. And then these newspaper clippings of them talking about like all these fish are like 3, 4, 5 pounds and wondering what happened.
Yeah. How did we end up here? Like, how did we end up here?
Yeah. I mean, and that is the evolution of the way it happened. I mean, back then there weren't that many people. Another thing about that was the fact that there weren't that many people out there on the water doing it, the camaraderie amongst anglers and boaters, the way anglers treated each other out there on the water. I mean, there was always, you know, if you saw before the age of cell phones, before everything that we have now, the communication, the ability to communicate, you looked out for each other. There was a big concern for each other on the water. And as a kid, I mean, I got pictures of me and my dad holding stringers that we couldn't pick up out of the water, but it was a matter of perspective. If people thought that it was inexhaustible, that it was an infinite amount of fish out there, that we would never come to the point, or I mean, I don't know if you could say that we thought we never would, because we never contemplated that far into the future. But at that time and place, it just appeared to be an infinite resource, that there were that many fish to be caught. But you look at the boats. I mean, we were running in a wooden boat. I don't remember what model it was, but I remember riding in there and you could watch the slats on the floor, kind of shifting around. It had a 90 horse Johnson that was as big as a Volkswagen on the back of that thing, you know, and you carried a toolbox and you carried extra propellers. You took all this stuff with you because you were self-sufficient. But the mentality of fishing then was just very different. Look at the boats that are out there now, the amount of people, the amount of information in a very short time. I mean, 30 years in the history of speckled trout is a fraction of a fraction of, you know, of the way things have evolved over, changed in a short time compared to, you know, how long speckled trout have lived in the bays. They've been there forever. People have multiplied. Boats are engineering works of art, you know, to get where you want to go. The information. And another thing, back then, when you had those spots where you could catch speckled trout, when you could get there, there were secrets. Nobody told their secrets. I mean, if you came in with a boatload of fish, you weren't going to tell nobody where that
and
came
nobody
from.
Nobody asked.
Well, they knew better because you were going to lie to them if they asked. And now, you know, click on YouTube, click on anything, and there's a detailed step-by-step instruction of how to get to where you need to be. So there's no, and back then the reason it was kept as a secret is because you earned it. It wasn't, you didn't click on YouTube and watch some videos and say, all right, man, I'm going for my big fish. You spend a lifetime out there learning how to do that. And, you know, that's why it was held in such a high regard.
Yeah. You had to be friends with somebody older than you that, you know, that knew something, Yeah, that was how I got into it. You know, it was hanging out at the sporting goods store, you know, at Marburgers over on Pasadena. There was another Marburgers, by the way, guys. It was the second one. Wow. It was over on.
I was thinking the Seabrook
one. Yeah, 146. Yeah.
Now there was one on Spencer Highway. Right at Strawberry.
I was blessed by my father. He was a trout fisherman, so I was kind of brought into my father's wing, and he taught me what he knew, and then I evolved to where I am now. But you know, when I kayak guiding, I don't know if it was the same for you guys. My passion's always been with trout, but when you're guiding a lot more people, this era seems to be people like the whole sight cast and seeing the redfish and getting into the marsh, getting skinny or getting the backwaters. Like that's what people, most of the customers want to do and want to see. Maybe that's because of YouTube videos and media, social media and stuff like that. But if it was my choice, I would love to do trout fishing over red fishing just because just born, raised trout fishermen, love doing it. But customers got to give them what they want, and kind of led more to red fishing than trout fishing seemed to be my issue up here in the Galveston coast. Was that kind of the same for you guys guiding, or is it just, you know, you mind explaining on
redfish right. Over time.
Yeah.
Guiding is very different than fishing. I mean, when you're guiding, you have 6 or 8 hours to entertain these people and catch them their fish. And then whenever me and Scott, I mean, if we're out there on our own, I mean, if we don't come home with any fish, we're cool with that. We're pursuing, you know, that specific sight cast for that one good fish. And it's not about numbers. Guiding is about, you know, numbers and entertaining the folks. You got a short time to do that.
So let's change topics here a little bit. Let's get in more to the meat and potatoes before we get lost into more stories. How did this whole trend or this whole stuff push towards the three rule? What was y'all's influence in it, and how did it come to be? You know, you guys were a big influence on this, so would like to hear your side and or not hear the truth on how it came to be.
Well, it's just something that, yeah, I saw it coming. I saw it needed to be done. I can't tell if I'm still on here or not, honestly.
No, you're on. We're all just quiet. We're waiting to hear it. Okay. I'm sorry. I guess I said, just a.
No, it's cutting. It was kind of cutting in and out on me here. I'm out in the country. I don't have real good internet sometimes.
Okay.
But
what was your influence, Scott Knoll, on the three rule?
Well,
and I just. Over 30. Sorry.
I've been watching. Yeah. My whole life, I've watched, you know, the limits drop. You know, as they go down, you know, there was no limit, then there was 20, then there was 10, then it was 5, now it's 3. It's simple math. Over the last 10 years, we've gone from 1 million saltwater fishing licenses sold to 1.2 million. And in that time, our trout, so there's more people wanting a piece of the pie, and the pie's getting smaller. So one way to make everybody happy is to cut the pieces smaller. The population is definitely, you know, definitely down. I mean, we all see that. I don't think there's anybody out there that's been fishing for any length of time that'll tell you that the fishing's better now than it ever was. You know, you start talking to guys like us, and we talk about the good old days and, you know, how many fish we caught and all that. And everybody kind of rolls their eyes sometimes, I think. You know, no, yeah, they're just, you know, fantasizing and remembering. But it really was. I mean, it was incredible going out and being able to catch 20, 30, 40 fish in their, you know, average. And then you throw in the occasional, you know, 7, 8s. it wasn't that unusual. And I think it's pretty unusual these days. I'd like to see it get back to that. And that's part of why I got involved with it and was looking to help out in any way I could. And I got asked to go to Austin to speak before the commission. And I went up there and spoke my piece about it. And that's the direction that they were headed anyway. But we got a little bit of extra thrown in on top of it with the 30-inch fish. I think that's a really good rule, and it should help us kind of even things out, because you're looking at it's like a pyramid. You know, if you really look at a population, there's a whole bunch of the small fish are the base of the pyramid. Then it, you know, as they get bigger, it gets, you know, fewer and fewer as it gets larger. And then at the very top of the pyramid, then you've got your 30s and over. I think what we're missing right now is a whole bunch of the mid-sized fish. And with these regulations, hopefully that'll be fixed.
And, you know, you talk when you ask about, you know, how was it influenced? How did this change come to be? It wasn't a small group of people that influenced this. It is, I've said this in the past, it takes generations to create change. So, I mean, this, it wasn't a quick decision. There was a lot of data, and a lot of the chatter on the internet is, I mean, we've beat this subject up. I mean, me and Scott have talked about this a lot lately with, you know, people come on as the law has changed and they're like, show me the data, you know, where can you prove this? I mean, the numbers have been gathered for years. There's tons of studies that have been done. There's surveys from anglers that have been out there. So there was a lot of influence that led up to the decision to change the limits. And I mean, we have the potential to create a trophy trout fishery again, or recreate a trophy trout fishery, because it's been there in the past. And due to the pressures, due to all of the amount of anglers out there and such, I mean, the influence came from many directions to lead to this. There were certain people who have a large, I don't know if you want to say a louder voice or more influence, but anybody can go to the commissioner's meeting. It is wide open to the public. I mean, anybody who wants to put the effort into stepping up to that microphone can influence the people that have the final say in the decision. And, you know, from 5 to 3 trout, I mean, 3, it's shocking to some people, but you're only getting 2 less fish. It's not that big of a leap. The size, you know, you can argue about, you know, what smaller sizes that you can keep, cut it off at 20. I was really kind of surprised that they cut it off at 20. I thought it would have been a little bigger than that. But the potential to create a trout fishery in a place that's unique. I mean, the coast of Texas is absolutely unique. We have barrier islands from one end to the other, from Sabine to Brownsville. There's amazing opportunity to catch speckled trout, and you just can't get that in a lot of places. So to protect such a unique area, to protect a fish that is held in such high regard, I think the loudest critics are the minority right now.
Yeah. And I think that one of the misconceptions is that this was some shady backroom deal for whatever conception. Yeah. I've seen that one around.
We've heard it all, man. We've heard it all.
and actually, you know, I want to see the time whenever it becomes that trophy trout fishery, because even in the very short time that I've been fishing, definitely not as long as y'all, but you know, even for me, my small sample size, I could see that the fishery has changed, and whether it's changed because it's cyclical or it's changed because, like what you guys said, the habitats changed, the number of people out there, the amount of people. We saw that during COVID, where everybody and their mother started going outdoors, which I think is great for the sport. You know, bring more people to enjoy what nature has to offer. But at the same time, more people also means more people fishing and getting out there, and more pressure and more harvesting of fish. So where we wanted to go back to that way, I think that's great.
Like the day that I caught the 50 something trout, the day before the limits went into effect, you know, it was, we had a 12 inch minimum, no number. I was fishing an area that was not a secret. I mean, it was, you know, a widely known area, and I literally was the only person there. I drove in, parked my truck, got out and started waiting. And I waited several hours and never saw another boat, never saw another person. You couldn't go there today. So that's the biggest difference that I see. You know, in addition to, you know, water quality and all those different issues that we're facing, and degradation of the marsh and the habitat and the oyster reefs and all that. But it's just sheer numbers, man. There's so many people out there wanting to enjoy it, and the fishery just can't sustain that number of people with higher limits. It's just not possible.
And to follow up on that, you can't limit the people. I mean, there's been conversation on limiting guides and how much pressure the guides put on the resource. I get all that, but you're not going to stop the people. I mean, here where I live, Aransas Pass, Rockport, Port Aransas, the population just in my little corner of the world. And if you want to go look at Matagorda, look at Port O'Connor, look at the growth. Look at what is there now. Every house that they build is going to have a carport with a boat under it. So there's more people that you're never going to be able to stop the people from fishing. The only thing that you can change is what comes out of the water, is what we take out of there. So, yeah, I mean, it's like Merrill said in the beginning, you know, we want our kids to enjoy what we enjoyed. And you have to leave a seed. And for the amount of people that are out there, it may seem shocking at the moment, but you still have to limit what comes out of the water. I've tried to put the mentality of the bays to what the bass fishermen do. I mean, look at what the bass world did by instigating or encouraging, teaching people to put the fish back in the water. I mean, it's a concept that is growing more to saltwater, but it's a slow process. But yeah, you can only limit what the people take out, because there's going to be more. It's crazy fishing out right now in February. I got this place to myself. Every day you can fish for an hour or two in one spot, you get an idea, you go to your second spot, nobody's been there, there's undisturbed fish. January, February early until spring break, it's amazing how the environment is out there. But come spring break, from spring break until the end of summer, you don't get a second spot to go to. You're going to fish the first spot you pick, and you're going to get there before daylight if you want it undisturbed. And the second spot you go to has already had somebody there or had boats running through it. And there are no sanctuaries left. There used to be places that were far away corners of the bay, but you can't, there's no place that is left untapped, is what I'm trying to say. And we're tapping it pretty hard, and that's why we're where we're at.
Hey, I'm confused about the bass thing. We're not supposed to be eating bass.
Yeah.
No, I'm teasing.
Hey, man, how would you like?
I mean, those 10-pound bass. We're not supposed to be eating those 9 to 10-pound bass.
I've heard Scott say this. He's like, "How would you go up to Lake Fork and come into the cleaning table and throw 20 bass up on that table and start cutting them up. They would put, they would cut you up.
I mean, it's actually real funny because I think because of the way the bass fishermen have done it with the conservation of bass, it's become now where so many people have never eaten bass and they think that we don't eat bass because they taste horrible, which they're not, but
I ate a lot of bass growing up.
But you talk to a lot of bass, a lot of people now, and I was just not bass fishermen, but I was just saying people in general, and they're like, oh, people, they see on TV, they see in social media, everything, they just put bass back, and their perception is they probably, it's a sport fish, and they also, they probably don't taste good. That's why we don't keep them. But I completely understand the sentiment of having so many people out there, especially when it gets warmer. Scott, I don't know if you're referring to San Luis Pass, but when I kayak out there, I like to get out there early. And I remember one of the first few times I went out there in my kayak to kayak out to one of those bars so I could hop out and wade. And as I got out and I started fishing, I started catching fish. And then as the sun just started peeking out, I started hearing this low hum. And I'm like, man, that sounds like mosquitoes. There's a bunch of mosquitoes coming. But it turned out to be like all the boat just start coming out because of the first light. And pretty soon I was just surrounded by, you know, I was out there by myself in the dark. And all of a sudden now there's like 7, 8, 9, 10, 12 plus boats out there.
That's the way it works. I've been watching some of the comments along the way here. And, you know, somebody asking about, you know, the seagrasses and the oyster beds and all that. Does anybody do anything for it? Yes. CCA, Flatsworthy, Galveston Bay Foundation. There's opportunities out there if you want to get involved and help the help plant seagrasses. I've done it. I did it in Galveston. We planted cordgrass. Cordgrass is one of the best things there is along the edge of the marsh in order to increase the shrimp population. Our shrimp grow up in the cordgrass. We did several deals with the kayak groups way back in the TKF days. We planted some areas that they couldn't get to. You couldn't walk in them. They were so soft and muddy, and they were rebuilding some marshes over there in Pierce. And we took the kayaks and we loaded them up with sprigs of cordgrass and just went out there and started planting. And when I left, Gal was gorgeous. I mean, it was full of redfish, full of shrimp, and it had been just a mud hole prior to that. So yes, there are people doing things along those lines, and we need to do more of it. And Flatsworthy, CCA, I know CCA gets a bad rap from a lot of people, and there's folks that really don't like CCA. I don't like everything they do either, but if it weren't for CCA, we wouldn't have anything to be sitting here talking about. Our fish would be gone.
It is, the conservation issues a very, very multifaceted approach. I mean, we can get into marsh restoration, oyster restoration. There was a huge move north of Rockport to close areas to the oyster fishing over the last couple of years. Flatsworthy, we had a big contingency that went to Austin and spoke on behalf of that. Those areas ended up being closed to the army of oyster boats that would invade these areas, and they rake and drag every square inch of the bottom. So preserving those reefs, huge factor in how to do that. We have runoff issues. There's pollution, there's water quality. So when we talk about the fish that we catch and take out of there, the human element, it comes from many directions. I look out here on the horizon of Redfish Bay in the 20. So I've been guiding. This is 22 years for me. And the horizon has changed dramatically. Just the look across the sky, the industry, the cranes, the drilling rigs, the ships that pass through there every day. The waves that roll in from the Corpus Christi Channel from the tankers, they've built riprap around Ransom Island and Dagger Island and all around Ingleside Point. The people in Ingleside are having huge issues with erosion on their shoreline from the tanker traffic, which of course so degrades the seagrass. The turbulence dirties the water and it kills the seagrass. Ransom Flats, which is 10 minutes from where I'm sitting right here. I mean, I can get on my boat and 15 minutes I can be in the middle of Ransom Flats. The seagrass there, from what it was 20 years ago, it was the most lush, undisturbed seagrass beds. Every square inch has prop scars in it now. And that's another interesting factor. 10 to 15 years ago, there was a huge push to protect the seagrass. There were areas that were voluntary, no prop zones. And ain't nobody volunteered for nothing. It didn't change. The boat still ran through those areas. But it was a state scientific area is what it was designated. And that and then it ended up, I mean, there's a statewide law that you cannot uproot seagrass on the flats. But I go out there and I fly a drone over the flats and look down on that water and look at what the seagrass is now compared to 10 years ago. What's it going to be? And my prediction is that in 10 years, there won't be any seagrass on Ransom Flats. It's a grim prediction. I hate to see it happen. I hate to think about it happen. It's one of the most beautiful, amazing flats to drift across. But day after day, I watch it get less and less. And there's more boats. You watch the muddy rooster tails when they blast off. Right now, it's super low tide. Boats run into places that they went 6 months ago when the tide was high and you couldn't touch the bottom. And then they try to duplicate that and they end up stuck, end up churning. And the damage and the prop scars do not go away. I mean, and there's tons of science for that. I could beat that up for hours. The seagrass, you dig a prop scar, the other dead grass falls into that prop scar. It actually prevents grass from growing back through those areas. Then the seagrass becomes segmented. There's trails cut through it. There are studies that showed like the little creatures that live in the grass, they won't go across those prop scars. It's like a, what's the thing they dig around the castle? The moat. It's like a moat. They become segmented. And so what's in that area stays there. They just don't travel across the prop scars. All the little fishes, the shrimps and the crabs, if they crawl out in the open, they're subject to get eaten. So they just don't that. So the segmenting of the seagrass, the degradation, the industrial encroachment, especially in Corpus Christi Bay, Redfish Bay, it's happening at an exponential rate, which puts a huge, I mean, it is a big part of where the speckled trout went.
Well, and that's actually some real good info. So if take it. I know there's a lot of good information here, so, but that's one thing I'm definitely going to take away. Hearing the science about that, about prop scars, that's very interesting.
Another thing to touch what Flocko Lerma was talking about. So we did allow certain oyster farmers, these bigger companies, to come in Galveston Bay. And we have seen, like you were talking about, Dean Thomas, a lot less seagrass, and I think maybe there's a lot going on to this puzzle, and I think Flocko Lerma is just experiencing like what he's saying and what he's seen, and Scott's given a solution about maybe we should get, you know, us noticing and seeing this, maybe we should get more involved. But yeah, you know, there's a lot of pieces to this puzzle other than just, you know, more people being on the water and taking these trout out of our water. I shouldn't say our, but out of the water. You know, we're messing up their habitat. We're messing up where they breed. So these guys are getting hit from, these trout are getting hit from all angles. Seeing, you know, and they're taking a hit. And I think us lowering the limit would help these guys get back on this growth pattern and maybe that's also a contributing factor is what can we do as anglers? And I think this trout rule is this, you know, three trout rule is going to help help them get back and help them have a better fighting chance. And, you know, I'm all for having a better trout fishery than not having one, you know? But yeah, you know, how do we, you know, there's a lot of money influence on these big trout, companies coming in and digging up our oysters, and most of these trout loved hanging over these oysters, industrializing all these around these. I know just in Clear Lake alone, I'm noticing a big change. When we get just a little bit of water, it has such an impact now. I'm seeing new culverts being built on Taylor Lake, Clear Lake, Clear Creek. So all these new culverts, all this new drainage, all this new industrialization that's going on, more and more water's coming out of these areas. It's taking a while for it to get, you know, the salinity back where it used to be. That also affects the seagrass that we have. So that, you know, just, you know, just
salinity, the salinity has a big effect on breeding as well. Yeah. Trout need a specific salt content to breed. And the more concrete you lay out there, like, we're not going to slow down progress. There's going to be more concrete. And for every square foot of concrete, that's where we're around. And now it runs off. And it brings all the oil and pollutions and everything that's on that concrete goes right into the bays. So places around like Galveston, man, I don't know how it even survives, honestly.
Many spills just within the last 2 years. It's unreal.
Well, something else you hit on, the oysters. What people don't seem to get, yeah, you know, yes, oysters regenerate. You know, they grow, and if you do it right, supposedly, you know, they'll live. You know, and they'll reproduce and they'll come back and everything will be good. The problem is, it's what they found is what they call the relief of the reef, which means the vertical relief of it. And what oyster people want to do is they want to knock the top off and spread it all out as they're taking the oysters off, and they spread them out and make them lower and lower and lower. Oyster reefs try to grow up. And the reason they do that is when you do get a big storm, you get all the silt. And if you flattened them out, now the silt covers them up and that kills it. And that's what's happened in Galveston. With Harvey, it really did a number because they've been beat up so long and they've been knocked down for so long. And Hannah's and Deep Reef and all that over there used to come really close to the surface. I haven't been over there in years, but it's my understanding that there's not any surface oysters out there in East Bay anymore.
Maybe by Frozen Point, but other than that, you're right. Even Frozen Point's taking a hit too.
Well, if you look historically at the Galveston Bay Complex, there's some pretty cool history books about all of it. They used to run wagon trains across from Eagle Point over to Smith Point. Think about that. They rode horses across what is now open Galveston Bay on low tides. The Indians walked across from the mainland over to Galveston. That's where Karankawa Reef got its name. And those were huge complexes of oyster reefs. That slows down the flow. It cleans the water, does all the good things that we want to happen to the bay. All that's gone. So the filters are gone. So with the filters gone, then the water's going to stay more turbid. The grasses can't grow. It's just one thing leading to another. You know, it's just a slow moving train wreck. If you want to, you know, kind of think of it in those terms, you know, just one little thing happens and then that leads to something else. I don't know that we can build them back. You know, of course we can't build them back to what they were. You have that big ship channel out there through the middle of it, but at least with the coming of the commercial oyster farms, maybe some of that'll help. I went to a meeting with CCA down in Rockport. And they had all the new oyster farming guys there. I think there was five or six different companies, and there's more coming online that are going to commercially produce the oysters, and they hopefully do away with this raking of the bottom of the bays, or at least slow it down and allow the oyster reefs to grow back. it's going to take years and years and years for them to grow back. But with some help from rebuilding them from the base and then allowing them to continue to flourish, maybe.
I know we're coming up on time here, and I kind of our conversation is actually heading towards that way. So Scott, let's kind of get your perspective, and then I'll ask you the same question, Dean. In the future, in the next, let's say 5-10 years, if this regulation, and we've kind of also discussed how the limits is part of one of the things that we're doing as anglers to help the trout population. There's also other things. Hopefully we can volunteer some more time and put more grass out there and, you know, maintain and help the habitat of around Galveston grow, or and just in general around Texas, the Texas Basin. But what are we looking at for the trout population in the future in terms of fishing?
Well, if you look over at Florida and watch what happens in Florida, that usually is where we end up. It's been the way it has been since I was younger. And I've watched their limits and their limits drop. And we sit over here and go, man, I can't believe they dropped the limits to that. And then a few years later, here we are. We have seasons over there. I really hope we don't ever get to that. But they do have closed seasons and even more strict limits. Like we talked about earlier, with more and more people, it's kind of hard to say that it can't get worse, because it certainly could. I think with a changing attitude towards the fish, and if we can kind of get away from this attitude of a limit as a goal and get more into the recreational side of this fishing, nobody's out there fishing for dinner. I mean, we don't starve to death if we don't catch some fish. So doing it more for the enjoyment and being out there on the water, and I say for the right reasons, I guess. But with the new limits, I do see that our middle class fish are going to probably grow, because they're protected. And come next September, there's going to be another little piece to this puzzle of the new limits. The commission, while I was there, instructed Parks and Wildlife to look at producing a trout tag. So we'll be allowed one trout over 30 inches a year, and then a secondary tag if you use that first tag. So hopefully with a 15 to 20 inch limit, 20 inch trout, there's a deal out there. It shows all the ages and everything. I've put it on our Bite Me page a couple of times, but a 21 inch trout is about 4 years old. So if we can protect them beyond that 4 year point, trout will live up to 10 years. So once they make that safety point of 4 years old, now they're just breeders, and hopefully that we'll have enough of those to sustain a viable population.
Awesome. And same question to you, Dean.
Yeah. It's a good question, and it's going to be evaluated as time goes on. I mean, it's, you just hope that the people that are put in those positions to make the decisions on where we go from here, gather the right information. I mean, I feel like our current board did a great job on gathering information and coming to the conclusion that they did. The future is going to be very challenging. Just like Merrill was talking about, looking at Clear Lake and looking at that part of the Texas coast and the degradation of those things, I see that in Corpus Christi and Redfish Bay, and that is happening now. The areas where the oysters and stuff that used to, like when on low tide, they reached above the water. They were just gnarly oyster reefs everywhere. They're just piles of shell now. There's no more of those live oysters. So the conservation efforts that are going to take place in the future are going to be very interesting. the closed seasons, you know, that's another subject that may be visited in the future. I mean, we have a closed season on flounder at their peak. But, you know, with speckled trout spawn all summer. So you really, I mean, it's going to be very difficult to say we're going to close speckled trout fishing in the summer months because they're spawning. I mean, that's just, it doesn't even seem like a reasonable concept. There would be so much controversy over an issue like that. But it's interesting to look at the last 20 years at what I've witnessed out there. And whenever I started guiding, I knew guides that fished the previous 20 years and I heard their stories. So the next 20 will be very interesting, and we have to be proactive. We have to look at the future. Like Scott said, with Florida, the population of our coast is headed to where Florida is. In Florida, every square inch of land that touches water has a house. There is nothing down in the Everglades, and those areas are the only ones that really have shoreline that is pretty much untouched. Texas is headed in that direction. It is crazy to look at Matagorda. So whenever I was 18 years old, one of the first things I bought was a fish camp in Matagorda. It was the edge of civilization. That was like in 1985. And it was this faraway place. And when you launched at Matagorda, if you made it to the south shoreline of West Bay, it was like Mecca. It was this amazing place that was just an adventure to be there. And there now, you know, there's rows of million-dollar homes in Matagorda, Port O'Connor. So all of those places, Texas is catching up with that situation, you know, that's going to have to be dealt with in the future. And, you know, those people that sit on those boards, it's temporary. They're not there forever. They don't get to evolve a lifetime of learning and gathering information. Those seats are going to be replaced by somebody else in a couple years. And the data, the information that's given to them has to be accurate. And then, you know, we'll see where it goes from there. I mean, I think we've made a huge step in the right direction with where we're at now, with the way that this decision was made. And I mean, they don't give stuff back. I mean, those regulations, I don't think I've ever seen one in my life that went back in the other direction. Even with the abundance of redfish, and that's, I mean, we can go on a lot of these subjects. There was a conversation in the past about increasing the redfish limits because redfish were so abundant. And then the vast majority of the people out there were like, hey, hang on. We're good. You know, let's not mess up a good thing. So hopefully this regulation will increase trout fishing and people will say, you know, hey, it was a good idea. What's interesting on that, when the trout limit went from 10 to 5, man, there were people screaming bloody murder down here. I went to meetings, the scoping meetings, where guys were in the hallway yelling, "This ain't over. I know where you live." I mean, it was personal. They were out to get them. And you can't find a single person now that will tell you that the 10 to 5 was a bad decision. You know, that faded away. And I think this one's going to fade away too. And be interesting to see where the future goes.
Yeah, I wanted to say that I'm enjoying the y'all's conservation movement down in the southern coast. I've definitely seen an improve in trout fishing down there versus, you know, when we had the higher limits. So I'm enjoying what you guys are doing down there. I'm hoping that it kind of comes up this way too and gets a little better for us as well.
Yeah.
Well, so one of the things that that brought about this 3-fish limit was following the freeze. They did the emergency 3-fish limit down south, Port Mansfield, all that area down there. The Middle Coast didn't get that. You know, Matagorda and Port O'Connor, we got hit hard with the freeze, but they didn't institute the emergency regulations right away. we were way behind. They lagged behind, and then they finally came along and did it later. That area down there has recovered faster. They're doing much better in the places that that emergency regulations went into effect. Our trout in Matagorda, in West Matagorda Bay and San Antonio Bay, are down 38 and 36% over a 10-year average. That tells you a whole lot right there about where we're sitting. So that had a whole lot to do with it. And as far as one of the things y'all talked about with me beforehand was how people thought this was a backdoor deal and all that. It was a public meeting. Everybody was invited. All the information was out there. They had scoping meetings. They had, I mean, you couldn't go anywhere without hearing about it if you were in the fishing community. So it wasn't like it was some secret backstreet deal, you know. It was all out there in the public. And everybody, hell, I just walked in there and signed my name up and said, yeah, I want to talk to the commission today. It's not that hard to do. So if you really want to get involved and you're really ticked off about all this, get involved and go to the next one and speak your piece.
I actually learned more about speckled trout spawning and ages and percentages and numbers in the last year or since the freeze than I had ever known because of the data that was circulated and because of the access to social media where it could be so widely circulated. I mean, there were some amazing charts and graphs that showed percentages of spawning age fish in their prime and, you know, times of the year when they spawn more. So yeah, for anybody to say that there was no data gathered and such as that, I mean, you're just saying, look, and if you didn't see it, just as a byproduct of the situation, I have learned more since the big freeze than I ever really knew about the science of speckled trout.
Yeah. Jesse Sanchez was the one that posted that spawning age and how much they spawn. He was talking to me about it at the fishing show, and I didn't know he was the one that posted that. I just found that out at the fishing show with Jesse. He used to be a teacher, right? I don't know if he still teaches or not.
Yeah.
James. I'm sorry, not Jesse. James, right?
Yeah, he's not teaching anymore. He's working with the fish something advocacy. I think it's Heart Research. Anyway, he's working with Dr. Stuntz, who is widely regarded as the number one speckled trout researcher in the country. And he's doing the public relations side of that. And so any information you need about breeding speckled trout, the release mortality, all of that stuff. And that's the other thing everybody keeps saying with this new limit. Oh, we're just going to kill them anyway because we're releasing them. Well, studies have been done to disprove that completely. Long scientific studies, the information is out there. It's available. Educate yourself on it and do a better job of releasing.
And one more question is a big question. We're going to compare our bay system, and maybe I'm going to let you guys give y'all's knowledge on this. Our bay system compared to Louisiana, why do they have bigger limits versus our system? I'm going to let you speak on that. I have an answer, but I'd rather let you guys go ahead and give y'all's knowledge on that.
Well, Louisiana's in trouble. Their management philosophy has been different than Texas and in any other place, as a matter of fact. There's different management philosophies, and theirs was sustainability. They just wanted to maintain. They had no future growth, no nothing like that. And they don't do as good a job as Texas Parks and Wildlife with the surveys and finding out exactly how many trout they have and what the population is doing and all that, like our guys do. They are on the brink of a collapse from some of the people that I've talked to over there, and they are cutting their limits. But the reason that they've gotten away with it for so long is just the mass amount of marsh. And they've just got, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of acres of marsh, way more than we ever thought about having. I don't know if you ever go over there and fish in some of those southern areas down around Grand Isle and places like that, you can go for miles and miles and just see nobody. You know, there is a whole lot of open water over there. And so that produces a lot of trout, but they also keep them when they're 12 inches. You know, and that's going away now too. They're raising their lower end limit. But yeah, Louisiana's gonna catch up with it. You know, everybody says, oh man, their limits are still really liberal. Well, they are really liberal, but they used to be 50 when I was a little bit younger. And that was, you know, it was common for guys from Texas to go over there and just sack up, you know, go catch 50 trout apiece. They were all 12, 13, 14 inches long, but hey, we got 50 of them. That's not happening anymore. Yeah, it's gonna slow down. It's got to. You know, there's more people going over there, just like there's more people over here, and they're losing their marsh at an incredible rate. I've been fishing over there for the last 10, 12 years, and there's entire islands that I used to fish that are gone. I mean, they just disappear from 1 year to the next. The shorelines completely change. It's pretty astounding when you really look at it. One area that I fish a good bit, there was I saw some young kids out there and they were putting stakes along the edge of the marsh 1 year. And I stopped and got talking to them. They were college kids doing some study for LSU, and they were marking where the edge of the marsh was. I went back the next year and the water line was about 10 to 15 feet behind those stakes. And then the next year it was another 10 feet back. So they're losing land over there like crazy. And with that goes all the spawning and all the great trout populations.
And Scott said it all very well. I mean, I there's, you know, a few things to add to that. You know, the flow of the Mississippi River is way lower and slower than it's ever been due to the water being sucked up before it ever gets down there, which is another thing that was incomprehensible once upon a time, that they would, you know, suck the Mississippi dry. So salt water is coming in, changing the salinities. The biggest difference is the vastness of the marsh in Louisiana. It goes miles and miles and miles inland along the entire coast, where we have barrier islands and really thin slivers of bays along our coast. But they've definitely reached a crossroads there on where to go with the future. And I mean, you boys, y'all think we got some rednecks in Texas. You try to tell them Cajuns that you're going to take their fish away from them. So there's been a huge push from the public against the regulations, but they have their own battles to fight. I mean, if they want to preserve the sport, I mean, they call it the sportsman's paradise for a reason. It is an amazing, vast place, but there's nothing that is infinite anymore. And there are more people traveling from all over the country to fish there, not just the locals, not just, you know, your everyday guy that's out there fishing. They have the same issues with guides. There's a massive amount of guides that are taking people fishing, and they're going to confront the same issues that Texas is in the very near future.
Well, I wanted to thank both of y'all guys for coming on and talking to us. It's been an absolute pleasure. You know, this has been a very insightful talk, and I'm sure I know our listeners are going to enjoy this as well. Before we hop out of here, I definitely want to give a shout out to our sponsors again, Knocking Tail Lures. If you're looking for soft plastics, it's one of the best out there, in my opinion. I've used it for the last few years and they've been great. Go to knockingtaillures.com and you can order some for yourself. 4A printing, if you're looking for custom merch, such as our towels that we made or our buffs, give Aaron a shout. He'll take care of you. Also, if you're looking for a Facebook group to talk fishing and kayaking with up and down the Texas coast, go to Dirty South Kayak Anglers. Search it on Facebook. And if you're looking for real estate here in Houston, either commercial or residential, give Brittany Selesky a call. You can reach her at 281-740-0498 or at email at britneny@grindstonereg.com. Also, just wanted to give another shout out that we do have a website is up and running. If you're looking for blog topics about fishing and kayaking here in Galveston and just in general. I'm trying to get Merrill to actually start writing because I'm trying to get content from him. You can find that.
You do not want me to write, I promise you.
I told him that he could write it and I'll edit it for him. You can find that at onelastcastpodcast.com. We also have all of our episodes up there, or you can also just look us up on any of your favorite podcasting platforms. Thanks again, gentlemen, for joining us. Merrill, I want you to take it away. Give us one last, you know, this has been kind of an up and down conversation.
I just want to thank Scott, Noel, and Dean for joining us. You're a big influence into kayak fishing. Scott has a book that he's written. Dean's been a longtime kayak guide and also fishing guide. If y'all want to put y'all's handles out there and maybe get a trip with these guys and learn their experience, and it'll add a whole bunch of puzzles to your game. Just thank you guys a lot, and I would rather hear words of wisdom from you guys than me jabber on about a bunch of nothing. But if you don't mind, go ahead and pitch your handles on here, and I would appreciate that.
Well, thank you very much for having us on the show today. I mean, we always enjoy talking and sharing those stories, reminiscing about the day, and talking about the future of fishing. And you can find me on social media with Facebook. Instagram is the best way just to message me. If you search on Google, your Slow Ride Guide Services, you can find the office number. And yeah, man, appreciate you guys having us on today. And it is a pleasure.
Yep. Pretty much the same way. I mean, I ain't hard to find. And I'm all over social media. I got, you know, Captain Scott Noel on Facebook, and then my own Facebook, and then the Bite Me Facebook page. And you can get a hold of me pretty much any direction like that. It's Captain CAPT Scott Noel at gmail.com is the email to get a hold of me if you want to do it that way, if you're not into the social media thing. But I would imagine most anybody that's listening to a podcast is into social media.
That is true. Well, thanks again, guys, and hope you guys have a good one, and we'll see you out in the water.
Appreciate you having us.